Welcome to Double Take, critical, sometimes confrontational conversations about movies. Double Take is a Cinema Classics production hosted by Johnny DiLoretto and John DeSando. I'm Johnny DiLoretto.
I'm John DeSando.
This is the Double Take.
It is, boy. And we do have a Double Take coming up.
We do. This is a perfect Double Take setup. So we're going to look backwards and forwards.
That's what we do.
First half of the show, we're going to take a look at the new entries into the National Film Registry's collection. And then we're going to look forward to what we're most anticipating in 2021 in the new year.
Yeah.
So tell everybody, first of all, every year we hear this story about the Library of Congress and the National Film Registry.
Yep.
They name a bunch of movies, and then what happens?
Yeah, right.
And what's the point of it?
Well, you have the National... Well, you have the National Film Preservation Act of 1988.
Oh, that's nice.
All right, and recently reauthorized in 2016, advisory group to the Library of a librarian of Congress. Mm. So, so it showcases the National Film Registry showcases the range and diversity of American film heritage. That's one side.
Got you.
In order to increase awareness for its preservation.
Right.
See, now you catch that too.
Yeah, it's not a best of list.
No, it is not.
It's also not limited to a decade or anything like that.
That's
these movies
exactly
are just
right.
randomly chosen
yep.
from across the vast spectrum of American film history.
There are 44 there are 44 members and alternates representing the film industry.
Okay.
And then this board advises a librarian. Uh-huh. To ensure the survival, conservation, and increased public availability of America's film heritage. Now, a recent book that I've been reading, a fiction called The Electric Hotel, talks about the early days of the Lumiere brothers and Edison and others in the competition. But it does point out that currently 75% of all these movies, older movies, are gone.
Yeah.
And that has to do with, in large part, the celluloid character. It just disintegrates. And I think, I understand it that
maybe they
digitally,
just made too many films.
Well, that too. It's always,
you know, it's
that
like is, YouTube.
That hasn't stopped.
Our cinematic past is like YouTube's present.
Jeez.
Try making your way through that.
But I understand, as a side note, the digital isn't eternal. That also breaks down.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
That I did not know.
Yeah, yeah. Because I'd always had that.
We constantly have to upgrade it and keep, you know, like everything else.
Yeah. Well, all right.
Everything great.
All right. There were
dies.
there were 25.
Okay, 25
this year,
titles.
But we're not looking at all of those.
We're not going to.
We're just looking at ones that are kind of interesting.
Yeah, let's jump around a little bit.
Okay, let's do that.
Well, first of all, it was really great that this was a record list of films directed by women. So 10 of the films entered into the registry this year were directed
by women. Isn't that great?
So, yeah, it's about time.
And 7 are at least about people of color, if not also directed by people of color.
Yeah, and there's one I've never seen, so, you know, this is put it on my radar for sure, called Losing Ground from 1982, the first film to be directed by an African-American woman. So, you know, you can explore that. The other one I thought was really interesting is... Ida Lupino, you know Ida Lupino from so many 40s noirs and melodramas. Well, Ida Lupino is significant from a Hollywood history standpoint because not only was she an actress, she was one of the prominent directors of the time, of that classical
era. Female director, unbelievable.
Unheard of.
Yeah.
Most females working behind the scenes toiled as editors and mostly unsung.
Yeah.
So Ida Lupino was one of the few women to work both in front of and behind the camera. And she made a movie called Outrage in 1950, which actually very seriously tackles the issue of... What are you laughing at?
You're such a nerd. Who knows about this movie?
Nobody. The registry knows about it. That's why now it's important. It's about rape.
I mean, how do you know all this?
You start, you're laughing at rape.
No, I'm not laughing at you. But then... How can you laugh that Catherine Bigelow is included with
you
the Hurt Locker?
No,
you
can't be laughing at anything I was saying.
Isn't she the first female director to
win
the
an
Oscar.
Oscar. Yeah, for The Hurt Locker.
Yeah, so that's included also. So their diversity is well taken care of in this.
Yeah.
Well, also, one of my favorites of all time, simply because it you cannot expunge the images from your mind, A Clockwork Orange.
Yes, even though you want to expunge
yes, you
images.
Want to. I mean...
I think that movie right now is currently available on Netflix.
Oh, good. Okay.
And if you haven't seen it, or if you've never ventured into Stanley Kubrick territory, that is, I wouldn't say that should be your first foray into that man's filmography, but A Clockwork Orange is still, when I even think about it, I get sort of uneasy.
It'll change the way you think about Singing in the Rain.
That is true.
I mean, and I'll never forget that I took my daughter when I was setting up movies at my first college teaching experience. I was in charge of the theater. And I took her when I had to set up, my projectionist couldn't show. I had to set up A Clockwork Orange, and I brought my 7-year-old Thea.
Oh, nice.
And left her in the audience.
Oh, my God.
And you can imagine what my first wife continues to say about your father.
Right.
Taking you to a movie like that.
Man. Yeah, that is a dubious parental choice. But, you know, in so many ways, A Clockwork Orange still relevant because of the subject matter. But the theme of seeing and what we see and how it affects us, changes us. And, you know, more than ever, we are just flooded with images and, you know, from the news and from our streaming services and whatnot. And so I think it is a very relevant movie still today.
And I don't know if Grease is still relevant, but...
It's fun.
It's fun. It's fun to think of John Travolta.
We can't still just have fun?
I know, but I always want to think about this handsome dancer from that with one of my favorite ladies, Olivia Newton-John.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and the way he is now coming into Columbus with his 8 toupees.
Right. Another one. That I think is, we got to talk about, we don't have to spend a lot of time on it, but The Dark Knight.
Oh, listen, I think that's one of the quality movies on the list of 25. As you said, it's not the best movies. These are movies that are culturally important and important to preserve.
And we still have conversations about The Dark Knight, and it was one of the most, well, you know what? I would argue that it was influential. I thought... Hollywood learned all the wrong lessons from The Dark Knight, which the lesson to me was, look, if you tell a smart, intricate tale and you actually develop your themes, right, audiences will respond because they did in vast numbers. That movie was a huge hit. I thought the lesson there would be, hey, Hollywood, the audience wants smarter stuff. The lesson was, let's let Christopher Nolan do whatever he wants, you know? And so...
So then we got Tenet.
Right. Yeah, see? We got punished. We got punished for rewarding a smart movie.
All right, here's one. Again, another culturally important with a mediocre film. Lilies of the Field with Sidney Poitier.
Yes.
And you and I have often thought about how important Sidney Poitier was culturally.
Yeah, I mean, you know... I know in some ways, you know, historians look back and it was problematic because he was this white ideal or something like that.
Yes.
But I was reading recently an interview with Danny Glover, the great character actor Danny Glover, and he was saying, you know, it's difficult to overestimate the importance of Sidney Poitier and all the black and brown faces that have now... made a mark on this industry, owe him a debt of gratitude because of the path that he forged. And you know what? Take away everything. Take away the race. Take away the civil rights era and the context of that. I don't care. If you look at that guy, you tell me that's not a great movie star and a great actor.
Yeah, and you know, he was in another very important film, I thought. Guess Who's Coming for Dinner?
Yeah, even more so to me, In the Heat of the Night.
Oh, God, another good one, right?
You know?
Yeah.
That movie, even more so for me.
But again, race relations, so important and groundbreaking. And today, most of our loving couples in current films are mixed race.
Yeah.
So, well, let me slip this one in.
Yeah.
Because, again, it's an actor who has had a real influence on my life in the sense of my appreciating the talent of some of our screen idols. And that's Frank Sinatra in The Man with the Golden Arm.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Why do you think this movie is on there?
Well, that's a good question. It's like, you know, I interview for Georgetown, and I never know why they accept or reject students. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure they are not giving out their reasons. But I think that the drug theme,
yeah,
and then putting in Sinatra as a singer who became a profoundly important actor.
Yeah, you know, it comes back. Look, maybe it's because addiction is so relevant mm-hmm. to many of our conversations mm-hmm. today. Mm-hmm. You know, and historically, it does show that Hollywood wasn't as frivolous as the industry and a lot of the
good
movies
point.
Seemed.
Yes,
there was an attempt, oftentimes, a lot of times, like movies like Crossfire, to deal with deeper, heavier issues. We just talked about outrage, Ida Lupino's examination of the trauma of rape. Here you have Sinatra, one of the biggest stars in the world, portraying addiction,
yeah,
you know, in a major Hollywood production. So this was something that audiences weren't used to seeing. A lot of them didn't know, even probably it never crossed paths with an addict. But so Hollywood historically has always, maybe not writ large, but has always dealt with some difficult
issues.
It
sure has, yeah. Do we need to tell people what they're listening to now that we're
rambling
on?
Oh, yes, you're right. We went over our listening to, Mark. You're listening to Double Take, critical, sometimes confrontational, hopefully always amusing conversations about movies.
All right, let's have fun.
Yeah.
Movies of 2021.
Let's look at, we looked back.
Right, now we're going forward.
Okay, now we're going forward. What are you most looking forward
well,
to?
Well, you know, on our show when we did it with Cinema Classics, you opened up with one. And I'd like to hear you talk about it again.
Yeah,
the one you've been waiting 100 years for.
Well, I mean, everybody is waiting for this now. No Time to Die, the James Bond movie, as you pointed out earlier, Daniel Craig's swan song to the franchise, was supposed to come out in April. I have very distinct emotional memories of, you know, April 2020. We're getting news of this horrible virus, this pandemic that's, you know, holding the world in its terrifying grasp. And then I get news, we all get news, that No Time to Die is being postponed. And and my heart sunk.
I knew we were in trouble when they were postponing it.
Yeah, it was like, wow, I couldn't, even at the time, I couldn't fathom it. I just thought, what the?
They're putting it ahead, months ahead. I said, we're in serious trouble.
And
here. They
said, you know, we're going to postpone it until November. And that 6 month or however long that was, that stretch in my mind was just interminable.
Yeah.
And then, of course, wasn't shortly after that that they postponed it again, and they postponed another movie I'm looking forward to, Top Gun Maverick.
Oh, good. With the indestructible Tom Cruise.
The indestructible Tom Cruise,
wow.
Who is currently almost done, I think, or has just wrapped filming on Mission Impossible 7 and 8. Oh. And, you know, this guy... You heard the big ranting and raving, and I loved it, you know, because I think it shows you, one, Cruise's passion for movie making.
Yeah.
Here's a guy who is not only producing one of these huge blockbuster movies, you know, his name is on it, he's the star, he's the box office draw, he's definitely committed to giving us quality entertainment.
Yeah.
But here's a guy who's literally, I'm not exaggerating, driving motorcycles off a cliff and parachuting off of the motorcycle in order to bring us this entertainment. So when some of the crew members flaunt the COVID-19 regulations, I can understand why so mad.
But you know, one that we do have to mention, just because he is such a profound influence on filmmaking for how many scores of years now, Steven Spielberg.
Yeah. This is a weird... I did not expect Steven Spielberg to remake West Side Story.
Isn't that something? I said, you know, if it had been Baz Luhrmann, I'd said, okay, good, I can do that. But
if it was almost anybody else, I think I would have rolled my eyes, because West Side Story, again, is, you know, problematic as it is now to look back on it. It's a beautiful movie. It's an energetic movie. It's a classic. It's a musical classic.
I don't think Martin Scorsese would have done West Side Story.
I would love to see that.
Wouldn't
though.
That be interesting?
You know, I am a big fan of Scorsese's New York, New York. Which
oh,
is
thanks. Yeah,
his,
that's right.
His
that's
entry
right.
into the musical.
Good one.
It,
that's
it's
good
dark.
One. That's great. Right? Yeah. But he has a film coming out this year.
Yeah.
Called The Killers of the Flower Moon.
Right. Another very expensive Netflix produced project.
And starring.
Starring both of his muses.
Yeah.
Leo and De Niro.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's how they should bill them, by the way. Leo and De Niro. I like it.
And this is the 1920s, and something about Native Americans.
Yeah, and murder, oil, corruption, you all know, right. racism,
yeah.
All the big topics.
Yeah. Well, we have to mention again, we're hitting the ones you might expect, but after all, our audience is not as nerdy about this stuff as we are, and so they're going to identify with Matrix.
Oh, yeah, the Matrix 4.
Four!
We're still neck deep in the Keanuzance, the renaissance of Keanu's career, and reconsidering all the the great work that he's done and continues to do, John Wick and all this great stuff, and he's returning to the role of Neo. Now, here's what's fascinating about this to me, is the Wachowskis have recently said that the Matrix films all along were a trans allegory.
I'm glad they told me, because I didn't.
Well, you know what? Actually, I did always find it rather curious that Keanu Reeves and Carrie Ann Moss in those movies look exactly alike. They're like a mirror image of one another,
right,
the male
good.
And the female. And so I haven't gone back and looked at it again since, but I'm definitely curious post-transition, Lana Wachowski's transition.
Yeah,
post that, what this movie will look like and what it will mean to mainstream audiences.
Yeah, we're going to have some lightweights like Death on the Nile.
Oh,
Kenneth Branagh,
yeah. returning to Hercule Poirot.
Right. But he's having Gal Gadot in it, which I'll go to see it.
I'm in.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Right, but then you're gonna criticize me for introducing this one on our NPR show. But anyway, Venom.
No.
Let There Be Change. See, I knew you would like that.
There are better. I don't. Well, look, that the first one was such a weird, unexpected kind of hit. Can't take your eyes off of it. Hit. I think we're all curious. Yeah.
And I am curious about Tom Hardy. Always anything he does. Mm-hmm. And I will go to almost any movie with Woody Harrelson. So this is a good one.
Okay. One of the ones I'm looking forward to that's not necessarily in this big blockbuster vein is Wes Anderson's The French Dispatch.
Great choice, yeah. You have to watch.
Well, I always look forward to any new Wes Anderson.
Yeah.
I am definitely not one of those people that, are annoyed with his style and his oof. Like, I get excited about it. I think it's ridiculous to criticize a filmmaker for having a unique voice. Mm-hmm. What do you want? Would you want all our films to look the same and be the same? So I love anytime Wes Anderson has something in the pipeline, and this one looks like a really great, crazy, delightful mashup.
And I will mention this one just so that you can tell us who the director is. Dune.
Denis Villeneuve. Look, you laugh, but this guy is one of the premier A-list directors of our time right now.
No. This is the film, Dune, is about protecting the most valuable asset of the galaxy, which must be something else about Donald Trump.
No, I thought it was Timothée Chalamet.
No.
But you say...
I say...
It's Scarlett Johansson.
Yes, Scarlett Johansson, who will be.
Is she in that movie?
Yes.
Okay.
No, she's not in that movie. But she is in The Black Widow,
Her standalone Marvel movie comes out. So all eyes on Black Widow. And Dune, Denis Villeneuve came out recently in a very fiery statement criticizing Warner Brothers because Warner's, behind all their creative talents' backs, announced that they would be releasing all of their major films this year.
Right, streaming.
On streaming services.
Oh, I know.
At the same time. Thereby, really kind of sticking a knife in the back of folks who who love and cherish the theatrical experience.
Yeah. Well, there are some people who are listening, I suspect, who are looking forward to Spiral.
This is where you're going after that great...
I know. This is one of the soft movies.
I just set you up for a perfect segue into the ending of this show.
And
Spiral. Just, you know what? It is interesting because this is Chris Rock. He went and he pitched to whatever studio produces the Saw movies that he had a new idea for a Saw movie. And they greenlit it. And then... cast him. I think he directed it or something.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I don't know. I don't get it. Anyway, that's 2021.
And many years passed because we looked back at the National Film Registry's
what a great
new
show.
Entrance into the Library of Congress.
All right. Great show.
Yeah.